what it is. It's basketball. It's not a f***ing soft sport.
I love it, Gabe. I love it.
Ladies and gentlemen, hello and welcome back to the NBL Pocket Podcast. The title of this episode, Cotton and the New Deal, is kind of what I'm calling it. There's a lot to discuss about the NBL delegates, the 50% wage cut, what's now just coming to life. Reporting on this whole thing's been pretty murky, so we're going to jump straight into it. But before we do jump straight into it, I will remind you, rate, review the show. Join me on Twitter at NBL Pocket Pod and on Facebook, NBL Pocket Podcast. On YouTube, I've got the Incredibles, the NBL Incredibles coming out, which is where I take an NBL team into YouTube on the NBA 2K20, so that should be fun. But let's jump in. Let's have a look, a real look at this. I want to wind things back on this whole NBL deal. First, I want to talk about the NBL delegates. Now, here are the guys that voted in favor of the 50% wage cut, as well as the other conditions of play next year. The delegates were Kevin White and Brendan Tees for Adelaide, Cam Glidden and Jason Kadee for Brisbane, Nate Jawai, Jared Kenny for Cairns, Todd Blanchfield and AJ Ogilvie for Illawarra, Mitch McCarron and Chris Golding from Melbourne, Tom Abercrombie and Jared Weeks from New Zealand, Nick Kay and Mitch Norton from Perth, Mitch Creek and Kyle Adnam from South East Melbourne Phoenix, and Daniel Kickett and Kevin Lish from the Sydney Kings. Now, 15 of these 18 voted in favour of all the conditions. I wonder who voted no. Who were the three that voted no? My guess, maybe Mitch Creek, McCarron and Golding. I think they all had deals that ran into next year. But it really, maybe Kevin Lish, I think I heard Liam Santa Maria say he was very vocal on the issue. Maybe he was vocal for, could have been against, I don't know. But they're the three that I think probably had the biggest deals and therefore the most likely to not want to surrender the 50%. But it's hard to say. Could have been Nick Kay. Could have been anyone. Looking at this ABPA, the Australian Basketball Players Association, so they're the delegates for the NBL. Andrew Bogut is also involved at a board level and as a delegate for the Boomers, as is Joe Ingles as a Boomers delegate. The ABPA, the Australian Basketballer Players Association, is the name of it. Funnily enough, has no imports on its board of delegates. Now, what I'm struggling with this ABPA is to work out, is it for Australian-born players, or is it for Australian-born leagues, or is it for basketball in Australia? In its description of itself on the About and History section of the website, the ABPA says, the ABPA's objective is to grow the game and the players' position as genuine partners in the shaping of the future of Australian basketball. That sounds very nice, but I don't actually know what that means. It also goes on to say, we are the representative association of Australian basketballers. We are run for the players, by the players, in the best interest of all players and the game of basketball. Now, that sentence there is, it's a collection of words that I don't know if someone really thought about. We are the representative association of Australian basketballers. So is that Australian basketballers, does that qualify as people who play basketball in Australia but are born foreign? Or is it basketballers who are of Australian birth or citizenship? We are run for the players, by the players, in the best interest of all players and the game of basketball. It's a very vague way to phrase it. In the game of basketball in the NBL, at the local levels, at all levels, can you be all things to all people? So I'm really sort of thrown off by this association and how it sees itself, and also the work it does on a nuts and bolts level, how it actually does it. So my question there is, where do imports playing in Australia figure into the ethos, and how, from a practical standpoint, is their input registered and received and enacted upon? Why are no imports NBL delegates? How are delegates selected? Is it a throw your hand up and you're in? Do you have to be Australian? Because all of these guys are Australian-born by the New Zealand players. So this is where I get thrown off by this whole thing. How is the import opinion and feedback heard, if at all? Where does the ABPA see and forecast the role of foreign players in the national competition? What is their hope for the future? What plans are in action to bring about these aspirations? These are all questions that are very unclear. And certainly judging by the way they've voted or decided in the past, certainly suggests that I don't know what they have in mind for their future. Also, and this is quite important to remember, reports had Kevin White being cut by the 36ers on April 15. Now, I hope I'm getting these dates right. All I did was Google this and look around at a bunch of things. April 15 is when Kevin White was cut from the 36ers. It was first reported by Olgan Ulick on the 16th that the vote went through. So if Kevin White was cut on the 15th and the vote was on the 16th, was Kevin White, a player not technically in the NBL, still acting as an NBL delegate? My question is, have I got those dates wrong? If not, how can that work? It just brings out a little point where if someone wanted to challenge the validity of this vote, perhaps that's one thing that they could use. I don't know how they'd use it and where they'd use it, but it's a thought. Also, and most importantly, Andrew Bogut spoke about this. That report on the first initial reporting on the outcome of that vote came out on the evening of the 16th. That was a leak. It shouldn't have happened. Players hadn't been informed. Most of them heard from that on Twitter. The delegates had taken an oath of confidentiality. And Andrew Bogut tweeted about this and was upset about that. I have a pretty firm idea of who I think the leak might be. I have a sort of combination of, I think, three players who I think are the most likely cause. I'm not going to say who they are. I'm going to keep asking around. My big question is, you took an oath, you broke the oath, will they face reprisal? They should. When you take an oath to say, we're not going to blab, and then you immediately go and blab that evening, that is beyond reproach. That you've broken the conditions of a contract. Just like if Kevin White put that stuff out on the internet. That is a breach of the social media convention, and therefore there should be a reprisal. I want to know who the leak was, and I want them removed as a delegate, because they can't be trusted. Trust is important. And I think that if the leak can't be established, then we should see a whole new 18 new delegates. Because if no one's willing to step forward, then all of you take a step back. I'm just sort of sick of sports codes and leagues not behaving in a true and manly fashion. I don't think that's right. Let's talk about the 50% wage cut. And when I say 50%, it's 25 to 50, depending on where your gap is or where your money is, salary size. But obviously over 200K, we're talking 50% less. I don't have a lot of answers to this, but I do have a lot of questions that I'd like to pose to people listening. And hopefully some of you have got an answer or an opinion, and you can express it to me on Twitter. My first question about all this was, why was this instigated by the league? Also, when Emiliano Caccia from Sportando first reported this, he said that these conditions were put forward, the 50% cut, the cut to insurance, and also the line that said it was mandatory and they would be stood down if they didn't vote in favor. So if there's the ultimatum of either agree or be stood down, there's no really need for a vote, is there? Because your decision's made for you. But going back to my initial question is, why was this seemingly instigated by the league? Teams pay their players. The way the league is structured, to my mind, is teams pay their players in accordance with the salary cap, but they can pay them whatever they want. There's no cap on contracts. There's minimums, but there's no cap. There is a cap, but it's a soft cap that teams may go over if they wish. So why was this instigated by the league? It does appear as though the owners have come to the league saying, please, can we get consensus on lowering everything for all our benefit? Which is interesting. Secondly, why was it mandatory? Teams assume their own risk, as I was saying. So it does suggest a wish by owners to end the import, as someone put it on Twitter, as Matthew Richards, I think. Hello, Matthew. The unsustainable arms race between teams. And I like the way he put that. That's a good way to put it. If the teams have come together in unison, they don't normally do that, and it seems strange. Why was this league-wide? And I know that sounds pretty silly because they're all playing in the NBL, but what do the bankrolls and businesses of Jack Bendat in Perth, a retired land mogul, I believe, and the owners of Cairns, Sydney, Melbourne, they all get their money from different places. Some maybe more or less reliable than others. So I don't see how business in Perth, where I think they've got five cases of coronavirus, is different to other places. Why was there this uniformity by the teams? It's great, bon homme and fellowship and teamwork. But, interesting question. I mean, this is a league, these are teams that couldn't agree on the designs of their indigenous jerseys, but yet they can wholeheartedly decide on their payroll in sync. Just found that curious. The other question I have is, and this is going to, I don't know, 50% wage cuts over 200K. Is this the Bryce Cotton killer clause? And I certainly don't want to start the Wildcat fans on a YOS campaign. They're pretty good at doing that themselves. But the truth of it is, no other team's imports mean as much to their team as Cotton to the Wildcats. Machado, Patterson, Tate were possible exceptions. But, I mean, it was certainly trending as though the NBL MVP and NBL championship was going through the Wildcats by virtue of Bryce Cotton. Adelaide don't care about their imports. They've made that pretty clear. Melbourne don't seem to mind, certainly not as much about their imports. Southeast Melbourne, maybe they seem to like Robertson and certainly Wesley. Illawarra certainly don't care about their imports, or certainly not in the face of it. They didn't seem to mind in their recruiting. So it just seemed like the only team that really, the team that had certainly the most to lose from this was the Wildcats. And to a lesser extent, Brisbane, Sydney. Next question is, where does Cotton go from here? There's been a lot of talk about, Cotton's quit and, oh, good luck overseas. Oh, things are so shaky overseas in other leagues. But, you know, if the NBL's thinking about coming back on time, I don't see why the EuroLeague wouldn't. Not that I have any information. And yes, it is up in the air. But let's... short answer to that question is, I don't know where Cotton's going to go. But I think that the idea that all leagues are in the same boat as the NBL may be unfounded. And I say that because of the EuroLeague. And I've tweeted about this a ton, so apologies if you've seen it. But the EuroLeague doesn't release its salaries much like the NBL. However, some reports do pop up from time to time. And the one that popped up most recently is Shane Larkin, who was Cotton's replacement in Turkey with the same team. Larkin signed a US dollar $7 million 2-year extension, and that was as of April 14. I was trying to get a sort of triangulation of the reports. That's the date I've kind of come up with. Turkey is one of the hardest hit countries of COVID-19. As of April 11, Turkey first entered a 48-hour lockdown, which I believe was then extended. That's 3 days before Larkin has got his contract extension, or at least when it was reported. Now, maybe this Turkish team has committed that money before it thought coronavirus was so bad, but I mean, this is Turkey. This is not Perth, Western Australia, or even Australia itself. This is Turkey, one of the hardest hit countries. So the Turkish season, by the way, runs from October to April, as does the EuroLeague, so similar schedule to the NBL. It doesn't say definitively, and Euro money is supposedly never safe, but it does seem to indicate that this Turkish club, and perhaps most of European clubs, are operating as business as usual, or at least with some sort of willingness to spend, which is contrary to a lot of sort of the fear-mongering that takes place online. Be interesting to see what happens. Let's look at the NBA G League. Now, this, not saying that Cotton's likely to go there, but let's just look at the landscape. You know, perhaps this is the time for Cotton at age 27 or 28 to decide to take another run at the NBA via the G League. In 2018-19, G League players got paid $35,000 as a base salary for the 5-month season, which, by the way, runs from November to March, seemingly. However, G League players do get paid extra for NBA call-ups. In 2018-19, there were 50 players involved in 60 call-ups, netting those 50 players approximately an extra $225,000 per player. Another way of putting that is, if Cotton is within those 50 best players, if he were to go to the G League, he'll get $35,000 base salary plus the $225,000 for the call-ups. Provided he gets them, I think he would be in the top 50 in the G League. Now, that doesn't necessarily qualify to make it through, but let's operate under that assumption. That would give him a total of US dollar $260,000, or $405,000 using the current US dollar to Australian exchange rate, which is about 1.56. $400,000. All rumors had Cotton on $600,000 Australian with Wildcats. Half of that is $300,000. So there's an extra $100,000 in your pocket, Australian dollar anyway. For those fretting about international travel who say, oh, Cotton may not be able to get there, Bryce Cotton is a US citizen. A country cannot deny its citizens entry under any circumstances, coronavirus or no. However, his partner and daughter, I'm not so sure about. That would be another story. I don't believe they're American citizens, so they would not be able to attend. Is that enough to sway a person not to take a job? A lot of men and women work away from their families it would be 5 months away from their family. That's a lot of people working in Perth right now on the mines as it is, and indeed across this country. Also, just quickly, the idea that the Wildcats could tear up Cotton's contract and sign him to, say, well, rumours had him on $600,000, so he could sign a $1.2 million contract and get 50% of that and thus be back where we started. That would mean that the $1.2 that he's signed for counts against the Wildcats' salary cap, and that's as well as all the other players' contracts, thus rising their luxury tax bill well over the approximately $1.3 million salary cap to what would be a pretty fair amount. So if a team exceeds the cap by 31 to 50%, which looks likely if you're going to pay Cotton $1.2 mil, that's almost the entire salary cap itself. Teams pay 1.5 for every dollar they spend over the cap. So if they spent all their salary cap on Cotton, presumably they'd spend close to the cap again on all their other players, from Nick Kay to Steindl and so on and so forth. So you're looking at a tax bill of $1.5 million just to get your team on the floor, as well as the million you got to pay him and then the luxury. I wouldn't have thought that would or could happen. That's an expensive season for Jack Bendat or anyone in between. So I hope that gives a little bit of a picture to EuroLeague, G League, and other options for Bryce Cotton and the others who have opted out. Now let's look at the interesting opt-out candidates. Daniel Johnson has flirted with the idea, but we haven't had confirmation. I'm recording this Monday, 4th of May at 3:16 p.m. Close of business is when these guys have the chance to opt out. So they've still got just under 2 hours to make that decision. Johnson was certainly flirting with the idea. I haven't heard anything to this point. Casper Ware has opted out. Mitch Creek has opted in. And Mitch Creek is a huge relief that he has. The interesting one for me is Prather. I think he opts in. I think he's had a bad run of injuries. He's looking to get stable. See what happens. I've heard no news out of the Prather camp as to whether he's going to do that. Just quickly, if I can harp back to the idea of players opting out and renegotiating contracts. The reporting on this has been real murky as to whether players can opt out of a contract and renegotiate. I think that they can, but I have heard no concrete evidence either way, and I have asked. What's interesting is where they say a lot of people are optimistic of players opting out and then returning to the NBA, just surveying their options. Cotton's social media post, I think it was on Instagram, didn't give that indication. It was so impassioned. It didn't seem like I'm just exploring my options. Don't worry, Perth fans, I'll be back. It was a regretful, could have been tearful, emotional goodbye. It wasn't I'm surveying my options. Casper Ware's been very, so he's just opted out. He hasn't put anything out on his socials or so on and so forth. So he seems likely to be surveying his option. But Cotton, I certainly got a different impression from that post. And also Cotton was on, Casper Ware was on a reported, rumored, is probably more accurate, 800K. So that's 400K in the bank. That's still pretty good for basketball. Especially if it's that amount and you're looking around the 400K for the season he had last year, he's entering into dicey territory trying to renegotiate after the year he had, which was good and bad in parts. I spoke about this. Can players renegotiate after opting out? Not so sure if they can. Just a reminder also, the Illawarra Hawks are in voluntary administration, so all of their players are free agents. Their contracts don't exist, essentially. So you've got Blanchfield, Sunday Detch, Ogilvy, Nah, Froling, DA. They're all free agents and are available to be spoken to, which is really interesting. You would certainly think a lot of those guys have a sincere look at changing pace. Blanchfield first among them. He didn't look to be enjoying his basketball last year with the Hawks, and he's a good player, can help a lot of teams, especially in this current climate of lesser rosters and two imports only. That's all I've really got on the NBL thus far. I want to jump onto The Last Dance.
You guys not allowed. No, I'm just kidding.
What time is it?
In 3 hours, just under 3 hours, episodes 5 and 6 will be released. We've had the Jordan episode, we've had the Pippen episode, we've had the Rodman episode, and we had the Phil Jackson episode in episode 4. What I found most interesting about episode 4 was the Phil Jackson episode, was talk of him being this sort of basketball savant. The glossing over of him backstabbing Doug Collins for the job, which I don't think was an unfair description. But it really got me thinking about the triangle. And I've asked a few people about this with sort of lukewarm responses. But Chuck Klosterman has a good article about the triangle entitled Whatever Happened to the Triangle Offense? Because we hear how it's this savior offense of the Bulls and things, but yet we don't really see it anymore. And when we did see it, it flamed out in Minnesota with Kurt Rambis and Kevin Love in the sort of early 2010s. And then obviously it was an absolute calamity in New York under Derek Fisher. So Phil Jackson in that article says that the patience it requires, the triangle, the patience it requires to both teach and ingest it are not present in modern basketball. Sounds a little bit like a get off my lawn excuse, but let's read on. On a more technical note, it seems like the triangle is very post-offense, or you know, post-dependent, which is obviously been now categorized as one of the lowest percentage shots in basketball. However, the triangle does seem to embellish role-playing shooters like Paxson and Kerr. As far as I can understand, when the ball swings out of these situations, you know, it's a fast-moving offense and the ball moves, and that typically gets you open shots. Not pretending to be an expert on the triangle, still reading up on it. I have also read into criticisms of the triangle that it's too reliant on late clock shot generators. I think Mike Dunleavy himself, I think it could have even been in the Jordan rules, said that he didn't like the offense because if it stymied or blocked down, which it had a habit of doing sometimes, you needed to be able to throw the ball to a guy like a Jordan or a Bryant and then let them create in the last 7 seconds of the shot clock, if it came to that. And when you didn't have that, you're in real trouble. And, you know, there's a thought to that because it hasn't been successful in the NBA, in its Phil Jackson form, without that condition, Jordan and Kobe Bryant in particular. And so my question really then becomes, if you listen to that episode, they talked about how under Doug Collins, the ball was going through Jordan almost exclusively, and that was just not going to work. So is the triangle, is it the Zen equal offense to Doug Collins's go-nowhere sets? That was what I inferred from the documentary, and I wanted to look and see if it was true. So Doug Collins coached the Bulls from 1986 to 89. Jordan's usage rates under Collins. So in 86-87, the first year with Doug Collins, his usage rate was pretty absurd, 38.3. To give you a context, I think Harden's this year was about 40.1. So that's a lot. Remember, though, that's with no Pippen and no Horace Grant. The next year in 87-88, his usage rate drops to 34.1%. That's in Pippen and Horace's rookie years. Presumably, they're still adjusting to the league, not using so much. And then the year after, their second year, 88-89, his usage rate is 32.1. Look at it under Jackson. So Jackson comes in the next year, 89-90, and the usage rate actually jumps up to 33.7. 1990-91, it goes to 32.9, still higher than that third year with Pippen and Horace Grant. 91-92, it's 31.7, so a slight dip. And then in 92-93, it jumps back up again to the highest since the pre-Pippen Horace Grant Bulls to 34.7. Now, I know that usage rate is not a ironclad concrete stat of whether the play was sticking in Jordan's hands or moving around or whether it was an equal offense. It doesn't take into account what the defense was thinking or how it had to react to plays. But still, it is some indication of maybe it's a bit of BS. And then in the playoffs, it's even more egregious. So under Doug, the usage rates for Jordan are 38.8, 35.2, 35.4. Under Jackson, 36.1, 32.7. And then in the years succeeding the first championship. So those first 2 years are, well, that's quite high, 36.1. But then in 91-92, it's 37.1. And then in 92-93, it's 38. The highest since the pre-Pippen and Horace Grant Bulls, which I found very, very interesting. And if you watch the 93 finals, Jordan averages 40 points a game or something. He's just catching it and going every time. I didn't see a lot of triangle. I saw a lot of give the ball to Michael and get the fuck out of the way. And so what I'm getting at here is with Phil Jackson, who's got, you know, fourth billing on what is the major quote-unquote movie of 2020, and you know, the social media winner of the decade is Well, Bill Cartwright put it best in Michael Jordan Airtime. Never believe what you read in the papers. Is his legacy overblown? Was he the Zen master? Was the triangle offense this amazing thing? Or did it still just result down to, did it all at its very simplest and most basic form boil down to give the ball to MJ and get out of the way? The usage rates certainly suggest that maybe it did. Guys, that's all I've got for you today, Monday. I've got another episode coming out tomorrow, or depending on when, Tuesday, the 5th of May. And that's going to be a really interesting one. That's with Joshua Miller, who wrote a thought piece, a genuine university paper for SSRN about the hot hand fallacy. And it's really interesting. We talk about analytics and how it pertains to streaks. And I try and frame that in the context of Will Weaver's substitutions, which came under a bit of criticism during the year, and how, you know, you'd see players score and then get subbed out. Was that a good idea, a bad idea? And just what Josh's findings perhaps could have informed that thinking. That's all tomorrow on the NBL Pocket Podcast. As I said, subscribe, rate, review if you enjoyed it. And if not, thanks anyway. Ciao.